Hello and welcome to History in Reverse, a father-daughter science fiction podcast. Today we will be discussing Dune Part 2. Hello, welcome to History in Reverse. My name is Caroline, and I'm here with my father, Richie.
Hello.
And we are discussing the much-anticipated Dune Part 2. So this is the second movie of two movies, I guess, that they're doing for Dune. And it was a movie. It was certainly a movie. We saw it in theaters.
Yes, I mean, we've been gone for a while because life happens. So it's nice to be back.
Yes, it is. We've been looking forward to Dune Part 2. And we really liked Dune Part 1. So, Dad, you went back and re-listened to our Dune Part 1 podcast, right?
Yeah.
And what were our feelings?
We really liked it. So, you know, I think I was less impressed with Dune Part 2. I don't know about you. I haven't been reading any reviews just because no one's my opinion. But it seemed like less stuff happened. You know, like there were all kinds of twists and turns of the plot in Part 1. With the betrayal and the escape and stuff. Whereas in this part, it was just some desert stuff with some worms and some fighting.
I tend to agree. I think Dune 2 was a good movie. It's worth seeing. It's visually very interesting. It might be the kind of thing you want to watch at home so you can watch it in sections because it is so long and it feels long, which is a problem. That's a pacing problem of the story. That like when we were sitting in the theater, and I'm like really into Dune. I like Dune a lot. I just did, for our listeners, I just did a Paul Atreides cosplay a few months ago, which you could see images of if you would like. If you would like to follow me on TikTok at Belock on TikTok, BEELOCK. I like Dune a lot. I really enjoy it, and I like the first movie. While we were watching in the theaters, I was sitting there saying, oh my God, it's still going. And I'm like, and I know the plot. So I'm like, oh my God, we still have to do all these things. We still haven't even gotten to this or this or this. When is it going to end? Am I slushy? I'm out of slushy. I don't know what to do. So I agree. I think it wasn't as strong as Part 1.
I think part of it was that I think we prepared better to watch Part 1. Like I re-listened to the audiobook before we went to see the movie, and now it's been like 3 years, and I haven't really thought about Dune. So there's lots of stuff to remember. There's a lot of characters, lots of intrigue. So people appear and says, wait, who is this?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think there's an overall pacing problem too, and I'll just say it here at the outset. I think if you're going to do Dune as movies, which is a big question in the first place, do you do it as movies or do you do it as a limited series? This might be the kind of story that's better suited for like a 6-episode limited series on HBO, where like each episode is an hour and a half, and you have the time to really get into the nitty gritty of this world because it's interesting. There are interesting aspects that were skipped in this story. But if you're going to do it as movies, generally, I think for movies, either you do one or you do three. Doing two is weird. It's odd to split it in the middle that way. And it's the place they chose to split it didn't end up being like the right spot. And it like just made the pacing, it like split the story into two parts that it's not naturally in two parts in the book.
How would you split it into three?
I would have ended the first movie at the betrayal, at the fall of the city and their escape, which is almost where it ended. They had like an additional 45 minutes of film time of him sort of interacting with the Fremen. So I would have cut it about 45 minutes early, making it about 2 hours instead of three. And the second movie I would have done all of Paul's adventures with the Fremen, learning the culture. Basically, my summer abroad with the Fremen would be movie two. Because that's what happens. And then movie three would be the, oh, by the way, this is about politics section of the, like all the political intrigue, you know, Jessica becoming like truly powerful, like maybe cut it when they're heading south to the, you know, down south Aroni on Dune. There's lots of ways you could do it, but I would say 3 2-hour movies would be a lot more digestible than 2 3-hour movies. Because pacing in a 3-hour movie is just hard. It's hard to keep someone's attention that long. And even someone who's really invested in the story, it's hard to keep their attention that long.
Probably if you want to watch, you should watch the first movie for review and then watch the second movie.
Yeah, I would agree. So the good thing is that the second movie does pick up exactly where we left off in the first one. So you want to start talking through the plot? So the first movie ends with Paul fighting that Fremen guy and killing him, and that somehow making him like chill with the Fremen, that he kills one of them. I don't know, big question marks, whatever. We pick up with them in the dunes hiding, like in the sand dunes, hiding from these soldiers who are coming, and they have the body of the guy who had been killed. And right. There's that scene kind of where they're hiding in the dunes and escaping and fighting those soldiers. Now, those soldiers are from the Emperor or the Baron? They're the Baron soldiers.
From the Baron. So they're trying to hunt. So it's not clear in the movie, but I think what happens in the story is that the Baron takes over Arrakis to take over production of spice. Right. And notice in the movie, they mentioned the spice barely. So like, if you didn't know what spice was all about, you have no idea what the big deal is.
That's true. It is kind of an assumption. The movie makes a lot of assumptions about its audience. And one of the assumptions it makes is that you know what spice is and that it matters.
But in the story, what happened was Baron was trying to get the production of spice up. And there's these two guys, right, who like the Baron's lackeys. There's like the real evil guy, Fayad, right, which we really don't meet till like maybe halfway through this movie, through the second part.
Yeah.
Which is kind of late. And the other bold guy, I don't even know his name, who's like the other nephew. So in a story, the Baron has two nephews who are like brothers, I believe. And the older one tries to run the spice production, and he's falling behind. And one of the reasons he's falling behind is because the Fremen are sabotaging his stuff.
Right. So they're out in the dunes trying to more or less root them out. Unclear whether they know that Paul is still alive. I don't think in the beginning they do.
I think they think he's dead, yeah.
Right. So it's like they're not like after Paul exactly. They're just after the Fremen, those Fremen terrorists, you know, ruining our oil production. I mean, spice production in the desert. So, you know, it's interesting. I find one of the most interesting characters in the story to be Jessica. And it's so unfortunate that she gets so little screen time in this, because there's some cool shit going down with her and we don't get to see very much of it.
So let's just talk a little bit of background about Jessica, right? So she's a she's Paul's mother, right? And she's a Bene Gesserit.
So yeah, she's part of the Bene Gesserit order, which is this like order of very
women,
spooky, very spooky ladies who have powers, magic.
The voice, which we talked a lot actually about the voice back in the previous podcast, the voice didn't seem to play much of a role in this.
She uses it a couple times, and I think Paul uses it at the end, which is like, ooh, he can use the voice. But yeah, it's not super big deal. The Bene Gesserit are like kind of the like background like shadow organization that's kind of pulling the strings in all the politics, and part of what they're doing is like a breeding thing where they're like reproducing in a particular way to try to create the profit, more or less.
The kind of breeding to extend the order, and the Bene Gesserit can control the sex of the child, so only in theory girls can be trained, or women can be trained in the ways of Bene Gesserit, except Jessica kind of sidestepped a bit where she had Paul. And again, this is going back to a previous podcast. Jessica was Duke Leto's wife, Duke Leto's concubine. She was never married. He never married her. And she loved him and he wanted a son, so she gave him a son. And that was kind of against the suggestions, quote unquote, of the Bene Gesserit.
Right, and they were like, all right, fine, now we have a boy, let's do something with him.
And
so Jessica trained him
somewhat in the ways of Bene Gesserit, right? And at some point while they're hanging out in the desert with the Fremen have like a reverend mother who's like the elder of the tribe, right? Mm-hmm. Does something or other. And the elder, the reverend mother is on her way out. She's dying. She's old. Mm-hmm. And they want Jessica to become the reverend mother, the new reverend mother. Mm-hmm.
And this is a cool process because the reverend mother like inherits all of the memories of all of the reverend mothers before. So it's like this passing down of like extensive knowledge from one person to the next, which is not an uncommon fantasy trope. This is the thing that occurs.
Oh, interesting.
It's in a couple different that I can think of off the top of my head of a few different places where that happens. And they want Jessica to take that on, but they don't know that Jessica is pregnant at the time.
Well, Jessica happens to be pregnant, right? So we find that out at the end of the previous movie, and she mm-hmm. knows it's a daughter, right? Mm-hmm. So this is like, will be the last child of Duke Leto, I presume. Mm-hmm. And how does one become a reverend mother? What does it?
You have to drink the blue Gatorade. And then you become the Reverend Mother. So you have to.
So the as you call it, the blue Gatorade is it's called in the book the Water of Life, right?
Yes.
And at the point where she drinks it, it's the Water of Life. It's actually some kind of weird poison that. Mm-hmm.
It's worm poison.
Well, we find out later in the story how they get it, right? Mm-hmm. It's poison, but the Bene Gesserit body can manage it, right? So they can control, Bene Gesserit can control the bodies too. Basically fight the poison and inherit the...
Yeah, there's some great like dialogue from Paul that's like, Bene Gesserit trained in poison dissipation or some such thing. I'm like, yeah, okay. You have to dissipate that poison. You got it, Jessica. But it's a really cool scene, actually, when she goes. So the reason it's a little bit unclear in the movie, but what's happening is there's a prophecy about the Kwisatz Haderach for the
yes.
Fremen or
yes. okay. Yes.
So there's a prophecy about basically this dude that's going to come. He's going to be an outworlder who comes and saves the Fremen. That's more or less the gist. And some of the Fremen begin to think it's Paul, and. Because, like, he does the cool knife fight with the other guy, and they're, like, picking up on signs that they're, you know, attributing to being the prophecy.
Right, and to the point where it's almost funny, right? So there's the one scene where they're kind of camping out in the desert, and Stilgar, who's the leader of the Fremen, right, mm-hmm. believes in Paul.
Right.
So anything Paul does, he says, it's a sign. So
it's a sign, everything.
But it's not entirely clear from the movie, but from the book we know that the prophecies have been planted by the Bene Gesserit order as they travel around the galaxy or whatever, and they spend time on planets. They plant these ideas mm-hmm. that often evolve into like religions, and so then they can take advantage of the people by...
Yeah, and it creates this really fascinating little loop that you and I have talked about, sort of a similar content in science fiction of being able to see the future. Uh-huh. And if you could see the future, is there really free will, that kind of thing? Mm-hmm. This is kind of similar because the Bene Gesserit plant this story of this prophet who's going to come from the outworld and free the Fremen. And then the prophet, the person who ends up being like, marked as the prophet for the Fremen is an outworlder who is a child of a Bene Gesserit, and the Bene Gesserit is there to make sure these things that have been predicted in fact come to fruition. But the fact that they do come to fruition kind of supports the fact that there is in fact a prophecy. So it's like this very circular thing because Jessica knows what the requirements, one of the requirements being that the mother of the prophet in this case is to be a reverend mother. So the fact that she becomes one, like she knows that's part of the prophecy and that she has to do that for that reason to support this. But then she does actually become one. So wasn't the prophecy kind of right then?
Well, so I think that there are conversations between her and Paul, right? Where Paul says, listen, this is bullshit.
Yeah.
She says, no, let's make them believe. Let's enforce mm-hmm. that. Let's.
Exactly.
And then the funny scene when they're camping. you know, when Paul is getting ready to ride his worm, and the young people are kind of making fun of Stilgart, right? So it's like, the Gen X's or Gen Alphas said, "Oh, these old people believe all this crap."
It's really interesting, and so this is the kind of thing where, like, if this was a limited series, if this was actually, I would say, more than six episodes, if this was like an 8-episode limited series, you could get into these kind of internal politics of the Fremen and the fact that, like, the Northerners and the Southerners have, like, different beliefs, and there's, like, cadres of them within that that have, like, different, like, and the age differences and the tensions there. It's like, that's interesting stuff. And there's, like, one or two scenes with, like, a few lines of dialogue of that. One is when Jessica is taking the Water of Life and all the kids are, Zendaya and the other kids are outside saying, well, she's about to die because she's drinking worm poison with an idiot. And then she lives, and all the Southerners are like, the prophecy is true. But so she becomes the Riven Mother because she's trying to support this vision that Paul is, in fact, the Messiah for them, basically.
Right. So the kind of rite of passage for Fremen is to learn how to ride the worms. Right. And so basically what they have these hooks on pieces of rope, the kind of like hook, and the worm goes by, they throw the hooks, latch onto, you know, hook up to the worm and open like part of its skin up, right? So the book explained that, saying that they do that so the worm doesn't dive into the sand because it doesn't want to get sand to get in there.
Oh, interesting.
So that's why
okay.
it stays on the surface. And then you ride it. And of course, you saw the clip with Neil deGrasse Tyson talking.
Yes. We should link that. We should link that. Neil deGrasse Tyson was talking about the physics of this and like the possibility of this happening, and he was very upset by it. And I tend to agree with him. I think that you should try to be more fidelic to science if you can. Like physics. I mean, we know physics pretty well, so we should be able to incorporate that into our stories. But alas, we're here. We're riding worms.
Yep.
Yeah, so it's... I don't know, the whole, there's several scenes of Paul with the Fremen sort of learning their ways, right? And this is kind of a white girl in Africa kind of thing where it's like he goes and like becomes one with the jungle, you know, like he learns their ways and learns their language and like all these things and kind of becomes one. And like that kind of narrative, I mean, Dune came out, when did the book come out? Like
1965.
The 80s? Oh, even earlier. Okay. So that kind of narrative was like, totally understandable in the 60s. That's the kind of things people wrote. I do struggle with Dune as a modern story because I do think that narrative is, I mean, at this point, tired. Part of the reasons it's tired is because of stories like Dune. But also it's very hard to, it's not impossible, but it's very hard to tell that kind of story without objectifying the Fremen as like one monolithic people, you know, and being like, ah, the brown people, they do this. I must learn, if I learn their language and how to ride their worm and how to walk on the sand like them, then I'm just like them. You know, it's like a, it's not a great narrative and it's not as nuanced as the Fremen are, you know?
You said something very similar last time, by the way.
Yes. I am a consistently written character, okay?
So one thing that happened in a book, which... they did not even touch upon. And I would have to go back and read the book. But there was a period when Paul was living among the Fremen before he became the prophet and the little mouse. He had to like fight, like various Fremen would show up and want to challenge him to a knife fight. And he would kill them all. And none of that was even mentioned in the movie. Right? And then, you know, he got his secret name, Usul, and his public name.
Yeah.
Which was, what was that, the mouse?
Muad'Dib.
Muad'Dib, yeah.
So I once had a pair of mice that many moons ago, Mom and I bred mice, remember? When I was in college. And we our pair of breeding mice was Muad'Dib and Chani. So I know their names very well. Yeah, Muad'Dib. Yeah, I mean, so, and Muad'Dib is another one of those things where Stilgar, the leader of the Fremen, the leader of that section of the Fremen at least, uses that to substantiate the prophet thing. Because Muad'Dib means like desert mouse. That's what they call the desert mouse. But it's also a constellation that points the way or something along those lines. It's like a star. It has another meaning that means like follow me more or less.
Right.
And he's like, oh my God, you point the way. Oh, he's the prophet. Like, let me teach you about confirmation bias.
So anyway, so while Paul was having his summer out in the desert, mm-hmm. and of course he and Chani kind of get together. And again, that love story is very shallowly covered, I would think, you know.
Right. Chani is shallowly covered. I think my biggest complaint in the thing overall is that the women in the story are not fleshed out enough. And it would have really benefited the story to have them be. And Chani is an example. And Zendaya, who plays Chani, does a great job. It's not the actor whatsoever. The actors, I think, overall did a great job. Yeah. I would say it's the writing. It's the way it was written. She wasn't given very much to do, but to be the love interest who also substantiates the prophecy, because her name means like desert spring. And there's like part of the prophecy is that the prophet will be revived by the water of the desert spring. But yeah, so, I agree.
Let's pop over to the Harkonnen for a minute. Right. So,
oh, right. That's a plot. remember that.
And we also meet the emperor,
mm-hmm.
which all of a sudden there's an emperor.
is what's his name? Christopher Walken?
Yeah.
Is the emperor? Yeah. Which was a weird pull. Okay.
Oh, yeah, he's all right.
Yeah, he was fine. He did perfectly fine.
And Princess Urulan, who...
Is that her name? They didn't say her name in this movie. They just call her the princess.
That's right. I'm just looking at the cast. See, in the book, she plays a much, much larger role, because in a book, introduction to every chapter is like excerpt from a history of Arrakis, right? That she wrote.
Right.
So we
right.
know all along who she was. Mm-hmm. And
she's also Bene Gesserit.
Is she?
I don't know. She seems to have the training. Because she talks to the Reverend. I mean, maybe, I don't know. She in the movie, she talks to the Reverend Mother over on her planet a lot. And it sounded like she was at least in on what the plans were. I don't know if she herself is a Bene Gesserit or she's just aware because she's a political figure. I'm not sure.
Well, also there's the other one, Margot Fenring, who I confused with Princess Urulan, right?
Yeah, so another white blonde lady, yeah, who is definitely a Bene Gesserit.
Right, and she visits the Harkonnen to check out what's going on. First of all, the way they portray the Harkonnen is so clearly supposed to be evil. Did you know they were bad?
Did you know? They randomly kill the servants around them. They're literally shown in black and white only.
Right.
Did you get it? Do you get how they're evil? Did you hear the bad news?
The troops go step around.
It is a little basic. I agree.
So the spice production is not going very well. And again, it's not really clear from the movie. I know that from the book. Mm-hmm. So there's a line that the Baron, when he decides to put Fayad, which is the younger one, the really, really bad guy
mm-hmm. of super the bad.
Two nephews.
Fayad Rafa, yeah.
Yeah. In charge of production. He says, squeeze more. And that was something that came up in the book several times where the Baron wanted, you know, basically squeeze the Fremen and the people who work, the workers, to extract more,
mm-hmm.
more spice.
Do we ever learn in the movie where spice comes from?
Nope.
Do you remember where spice comes from?
Yeah, I think that's going to be in Dune Part 3, probably.
Okay. If they make a Part 3. We're not going to spoil it, but if you want to know, guys, go look it up. Go look up where spice comes from.
It has to do with the worms.
It does have to do with the worms. Yeah, so he puts Fayad Rotha in charge, and we get intro scenes of Fayad Rotha, which show him killing random servants and being very violent.
Well, it's not clear, right? So there's like a going to be celebration of Fayad's birthday, right?
Yeah.
And his hobby is knife fighting with the people who are drugged. Again, it's not
in front of crowds of millions of people.
So they can see him kill people and win mm-hmm. all the time.
Yeah.
And for his birthday, like what they have several, a gaggle of Duke Atreides' servants, military people who they kept as prisoners, and he fights them. Mm-hmm. Right. And typically they drug him a bit, and he also has a shield so that, you know, these funky shields that they didn't do much with in this movie.
They were present in the first one. They were well used in the first one. Yeah. The body shield. It's actually an interesting scene visually. It was a scene that was, I thought that it was shot in black and white when I was first watching it. It's because everything is monochromatic. But there's a couple of close shots of the woman Fenring. What's her name? Mm-hmm. What was her name? Fenring?
Margaret Fenring.
There's a few shots of her in the stands watching, because a whole bunch of Bene Gesserit are there watching. And when he shows her face, you can see around like the edge of her eye, like pink, like the color of her skin around her, like where like you would normally put like an eyeliner. So I think they shot that in color, but they just, everything was done in monochromatic.
Right.
I think. I could be wrong, but just like, it was really interesting. I don't know why it was monochromatic. I don't know. I thought maybe the point was supposed to be the Harkonnens can't see color, like they only see in black and white. But then later things are in color and everything's normal. So I don't understand. Maybe it's the planet they were on. That
was all on Arrakis. So
was it on Arrakis? I thought it was somewhere else.
No, no, it's definitely Arrakis.
Oh, then I have no idea. It looked neat. It was very cool, but I don't get it. I was hoping it had a deeper meaning. But the during his little birthday fight, the Bene Gesserit are there watching, because what we learn throughout the story is that there are sort of two bloodlines they've been curating to potentially create, like, you know, their little prophet man. One is Paul's bloodline, but the other is Fayed Rotha. So Fayed Rotha is like he's the Neville Longbottom to Harry Potter, for any of those of you who understand that. He's the backup chosen one if Paul doesn't come to fruition. So that's why they're interested in Fayed Rotha. But he's like a psychopath.
Yes. And I think Margot Fenring becomes pregnant by him after this visit.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, so they want to secure his bloodline. So she goes and she says, "Hello, I am a Bene Gesserit. Now we're going to have sex." And
let's make a baby, yeah.
And he says, "Yep." So she leaves pregnant with a girl. So she's secured the bloodline. And that is it for her. She disappears off page after that.
Yep.
Gone. Gonzo dunzo. That's the kind of plot that only matters if this is going to have a part three, or like if this was a TV show. That would be a really good plot to track in a television show. But a movie series, I'm not sure.
So then we cut back to the desert, and there's a scene where we find out how they make water of life.
Yeah, they have to kill baby worms. It's so mean.
Baby worm, and so baby worms live in sand. So we throw it in water, actual water. They kind of drown, and they extract this, as you call it, blue Gatorade out of them.
They extract the blue Gatorade out of me. It really looks like blue Gatorade. One thing we didn't talk about that I wanted to mention, actually, because I want to give the movie props in terms of its visuals. The Fremen have underwater oases all over the desert. That's really important to know. Not for this movie, but in the future. There is water on Arrakis. It is just not on the surface. It's in control of the Fremen underground. Now, what they do is anytime somebody dies, they put them in a magic device that sucks all the water out of them. And then they pour that water into those pools. So they don't use the water. They don't drink it or anything like that, because it's like sacred. It's all the water from all of the Fremen who have died before, which is like a really beautiful kind of burial ritual, actually. But it exists. They have these huge, huge pools of it all over the place.
Right. Yeah, I don't know if it makes sense that they don't use the water, because...
I don't know if it makes sense that the water doesn't evaporate.
Of course it does, but...
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. But alas, it's a beautiful concept. So while Paul is doing desert things, and he and Chani, they fall in love, etc. He rides a worm. They do some terrorist stuff where they blow some shit up. But that's all good and dandy. Jessica is doing some spooky shit in the background. We get like a scene of Jessica. She's like communicating with her fetus. She has like a psychic connection with the fetus. So she's like always talking to her daughter in utero. And she says the daughter talks back to her. I don't know. And she's, you know, now she's drunk the water of life. She's become the Reverend Mother. She's now slowly converting people. And we have this great scene where she's sort of narrating and she's like, we have to make them believe. We have to make them follow Paul. We're going to start converting them. We're going to start with the weak ones and convert those and then kind of move up the pyramid to the more difficult people. But we're slowly going to convert everyone. And we're going to, she has like a great line where she's like, you know, make them believe us, make them fear us, something along those lines. And it's super cool. And then it cuts away and we never see any of that happen. It just happens off screen. And it makes me so mad because I want to know, what did you do? Like, what did you do to convince people? What politics? Show me the politics, please. I don't want to watch him ride another worm. I want to watch you do politics.
After they show us how they make Word of Life from the little worms, Paul comes and drinks it. Now, why does he do that? Somehow I missed the explanation in the movie.
So Jessica drinks the Water of Life, and the whole thing is that only women can drink it because men die if they drink it because the Bene Gesserit. I don't know. I wonder if that's just straight up not true, and that's just the Bene Gesserit trying to control the Water of Life. I'm not sure. I'd have to reread the book to explore that theory. But basically, Jessica wants him to become the Kwisatz Haderach. She wants him to become the all-seeing prophet. And drinking the Water of Life gives you, for Jessica, it gave her the memories of the previous Reverend Mothers. But it also, like, she says, like, now I can see. That's just kind of how she describes it. Like, she can see now. It sounds like what it does is it enhances your, like, science fiction psychic abilities, more or less. And she wants him to drink it because she wants him.
But does she tell him to suggest he could drink it? What makes him want to go drink it? I don't really remember.
She wants him to come south. So there's a whole thing about him going south. He doesn't want to go south because he keeps having these visions that if he goes south, like, lots of people are going to die.
That's right. He has his visions, yeah.
He's also the unwilling prophet, right? He's like, I'm not special. It can't be me. I'm not the prophet. No, stop. Not my magical destiny, you know, the whole time. And he's like, no, I can't go south. I can't go south. And then the Fremen are like, we're having a meeting. It's got to be in person. We can't do it by Zoom. You have to come south. That's where it's being held. And he's like, no, I can't.
They were also being attacked by the Harkonnen, right? So there's like destruction of some of the...
They're fighting the Harkonnen, but they just choose to hold the meeting in the south. They could have chosen to hold the meeting in the north. There's no reason it had to be in the south, but they're like, Paul, you have to come to the meeting. All the leaders are coming to the meetings. You can't. We RSVP'd for you already. You got to come. and he ends up going south with them to this big like meeting of the leaders of the various Fremen. And when he gets there, Jessica is super blue. Her eyes are like so blue. And she's got all her tattoos and her cool outfits and stuff. And by the way, the costume's awesome in this movie.
Yeah.
Beautiful. She's got her cool outfits and she's like, all right. You got to drink this blue Gatorade. This is going to make you see. Yeah, this is how you do this. I forget if it's before or after he drinks the blue Gatorade that he realizes who her father was, who Jessica's father was.
I think later.
Okay, so he drinks the blue Gatorade because Jessica says to, pretty much. And almost dies.
But he just kind of falls unconscious and barely alive.
And then Chani shows up and she's like, I'm so sad. Why would you do this? We're in love, I promise. Stilgar is there. Stilgar's there and he's like, you know what you have to do or whatever, like to bring him back. So she cries and she like takes a tear and like puts it on his lips so she like drinks her tear or whatever. Because the prophecy was that the prophet would survive because he would drink the water of the desert spring. And her name means desert spring. And now he drank her water. Do you get it?
A secret name, yeah.
Her secret name. It's do you get it? And he wakes up. Then he lived. Yay. And that whole thing takes maybe 5 minutes of screen time. But he wakes up being able to quote unquote see. And he sees that Jessica is the daughter of the Baron, which means that he, Paul Atreides, is both Atreides and Harkonnen.
Not a daughter, maybe grand. Her grandfather was related somewhere, but it's like
In the movie, they said she's the daughter of the Baron.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know if it's who knows. That could work with the age of the Baron.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, and if the Bene Gesserit were lining it up, that would make sense. So then Paul has this whole like life crisis about, he's like, I am both Atreides and Harkonnen, and no one is there to be like, bloodline purity is stupid and doesn't mean anything.
So then
she's like, I didn't know either. Yeah.
And then the daughter appears, remembering that vision. Who has that
vision? Oh, yeah. Anya Taylor-Joy appears she zooms in for one scene. The actor Anya Taylor-Joy appeared at the Dune premiere. And everyone was like, what are you doing? And she's like a pretty popular actor. Everyone's like, what are you doing here? And she's like, I'm in the movie. And they're like, oh, my God, she's in the movie. It's a surprise. It's a secret. Who is she going to play? And then she appears as Paul's grown sister in like one vision for 25 seconds.
Right.
And that's it. But she appears on a desert dune in front of an ocean.
Right. Because, you know, they want to convert Arrakis into paradise with water and everything. And that's the implication.
Mm-hmm. She's like, I believe in you, Paul. Embrace your magical destiny. Then politics happens. And I don't totally understand all this politics. So he's now all seeing, and he goes to the meeting of all the leaders of the Fremen, but he's like now very much changed, like his whole character has changed.
Yeah, and then somehow they decide to attack, that they're planning a war basically against the Harkonnen to take Arrakis back.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I was unclear how that happened in the movie.
Yeah, he kind of takes advantage of being now having special science fiction psychic powers. Like what he does is he goes in front of everybody and he's like, I am your true leader. And they're like, no, you're not. And he's like, I can read your mind. And they're like, oh my God, he can read our minds. He is our true leader. And everybody bows down to him.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I forgot about
that's
that.
That's pretty much what happens. And Chan is the only one who's like, he's just a dude. He promised me he would never try to be emperor of the universe. And here he is going back on that promise. Then the various political machinations occur. And they had this like one big final fight kind of thing. It's super cool, like the way it's done.
There was this fight, way of fighting called the Weirding Way, which is mentioned in the book, which was mentioned in the first movie a long time ago. This completely ignored here.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you know what, the way Jessica could fight and the way Paul could fight was this Weirding Way, some special Bene Gesserit or some such weird way of fighting. They did not do anything with it in the movie.
Mm.
Instead, they used the worms.
Mm. Yes, they did. They brought many worms. They said, "What if we wormed you? Look at these worms." Yeah. It's quite a scary scene, actually, of the worms coming up because they got big old mouths, and it was a little spooky for me. So they use the worms. Where are they attacking? They're attacking where the emperor is? Because they get the emperor.
They were attacking the capital of Arrakis. But emperor came there because emperor wanted something.
Yeah, there's politics happening where the emperor comes to Arrakis because ? And so does the princess. So she's right there too. And there's some cool shots. There's like the Fremen hide in the sand and pop out the sand to attack, and Paul leads people and everybody's fighting and it's cool looking. There's worms.
And who kills the Baron? Is it Paul?
Yes.
And he says, uncle.
Is that what he said? I couldn't hear him.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So he kills... No, the Baron would have been his... Who said grandfather?
Oh, grandfather, right.
Grandfather. Oh, you're right. Okay, so the Baron was his grandfather. He says grandfather. There's another word he says that I couldn't hear because his mask was over his face and I need subtitles. So that's just me. That's not the movie's fault. But yeah, he kills the Baron. They capture the Emperor and the Princess.
Right.
And then...
And then it's going to be a big fight where he basically says to the emperor, name your champion, or I'm going to kill you, or I'll name your champion.
Right.
Right. And of course, he picks Fayad. Right. Yeah, and they have a great big knife fight.
They do. Where Paul gets stabbed.
Well, so see, this is the thing about, they messed it up a bit. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that Fayad used to do to make the fights unfair, he would have poisoned blades. Mm-hmm. So all you have to do was to nick somebody, and that would you know, introduce enough poison that they would get weaker and it would be easy to kill.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, we know that throughout the story that he uses poison blades when he's fighting Paul.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of important. So the fact that they didn't do that in the movie and Paul gets stabbed, eh.
Mm. So what happens? Do you remember what happens in the final fight in the books? Is it poison or?
I think, I don't remember. I would have to reread it, but clearly Paul wins. Mm-hmm. And then when he wins, and he wins in this movie, he says, I'm going to take hand of your daughter, meaning princess, and basically replace the emperor on a throne.
Mm-hmm.
And Chani's kind of not happy.
Yeah, Chani's like, what the fuck? What about me? I'm Zendaya. How dare you?
Well, you can be a concubine, just like his father.
And that's kind of where, and then like there's other people that are also invading Arrakis at the same time. There's like they mention in dialogue that like other houses have shown up to Arrakis, and Paul's trying to get the emperor to call them off.
Right, right. So basically, I think he wants Arrakis to be run by Fremen.
Mm-hmm.
That's
but
the
implication. He wins the fight, and then he loads all the Fremen up onto ships, and they take off. Except for Chani. She's like walking angrily to the bus stop because she won't go with them. That's what it seemed. That's what happened at the end.
Did it?
Or he loads a bunch of Fremen onto the, I don't know if he loads all of them. But they're like, it seemed like it was the beginning of some kind of galactic war because the other houses wouldn't like call off their ships, basically. Like they weren't accepting him.
Right, that was very confusing.
It was very confusing.
And that's at the end of almost 3 hours of movies.
Right, I was like, please let me leave. I mean, if something politics occurs and then the end of the movie ends, I don't know what else to tell you.
I probably have to watch it, like you said, with subtitles when it appears on streaming somewhere.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think... So I talked already about like my big complaints being the length and the pacing. It was weird. Visually, it was a stunning movie. However, there were scenes that were too dark. We were in a theater on the giantest screen available, and there were things that I had trouble seeing because they were shot too dark. And this is not an uncommon problem in modern media. This happens in this initially started happening in Game of Thrones, started happening in House of the Dragon. This occasionally happens on Black Sails. Shows that have like high production quality, for some reason, I don't know if it's like the way they're shooting, if they're trying to be like gritty and dark or whatever. It's just like, I just can't fucking see what's happening. Like, turn on a lamp. Like, if you want it to be nighttime, shoot it in the day and put a night filter on it. It is fine. It does not actually have to be night. And it doesn't have to actually look like night because I can't see shit at night. So I was like really annoyed because particularly in the beginning of the movie on the desert, there were like a lot of these nighttime scenes. I couldn't see what was going on. Mm. And I want to see it. I know they spent a lot of money on it. I want to see what's going on. And I do think that the story, my last primary complaint is that I do think the story failed its female characters, because even people who like haven't read the books, because I've talked to a few people since we've seen the movie in the past week, people that haven't read the books were like upset by the princess character, because I don't know if you know that actor Florence Pugh, I don't know how to say her name. It's Pugh.
Yeah.
She's a really, really good actor. If anybody wants to watch, what was the movie she was in? It was called Midsommar. She was in a movie called Midsommar. It's a horror movie. You might not like it.
No, but not for me.
What a fantastic actor. And that princess role was nothing. It was like she was barely even an exposition machine. She didn't do anything. Like, she just appeared there to, like, be someone Paul could marry. And that was it. There wasn't, like, anything to that. And it was, like, a real waste of Florence Poe's talent. And I think Zendaya's talent also.
Yeah, you're right. Jessica was kind of one that had more stuff to do, but...
Mm-hmm.
But, like, the love story between Paul and Chani was just so brushed over.
Yeah. And that's a big deal in the books. And it should be a big deal. Lady Jessica was played by Rebecca Ferguson. I think that Jessica character had any impact whatsoever on screen because of her acting. Because, like, she really pulled out everything for that role. And I think did an excellent job. There could have been a lot more story spent with these characters that there just wasn't. And I can't figure out why. Like, what did they spend their time on instead? You know?
There was lots of just shots of the scenery.
Yeah, there were the long lingering shots of the desert. Did you know the desert? It's deep and significant.
There were the shots of Harkonnen marching around.
Mm-hmm. Like, the whole scene of Fayad Rotha and his, like, little fight, his birthday fight. The length of that scene. That scene was so long. From the start of going to the Harkonnens to leaving, that was like 10 or 15 minutes of screen time with the Harkonnens. We didn't get that kind of screen time with Jessica at any point. And she was doing equally as important, if not more important stuff for this plot.
Again, like comparing it to the first movie, it felt to be like there was less stuff happened. It's like, you know, there were many more characters in the first part. Mm-hmm. And that just kind of disappeared. Like Gurney Halleck reappears, and I had to remember, who the hell was he?
Mm-hmm. He appears just before the end too. It's like the way that, that's the thing. Is like if you had split this into three movies, you could have ended movie two, in reintroducing characters like that, and introducing like Fayad Rotha, for example, and set him up as the bad guy of movie three. But here he comes in like halfway through and is dead in like the next hour. So, you know, what are we doing exactly? Like the pacing is off, and pacing is hard. It's sort of ineffable to figure out what is and isn't good pacing. I thought the first movie was pretty well paced. I didn't have a big complaint about it, but if this second movie is the result of the way the first movie was paced, then something is wrong. Like it would have been better as like three, not even necessarily 2 hour movies. You could have had an hour and a half, an hour and a half, an hour and a half. If it was paced well, you could fit everything that way. You don't need it to be super long.
Yeah. And again, the political intrigue was very unclear
mm-hmm.
from the movie. I mean, or maybe, you know, the first movie was unclear also, but we had just reviewed the story prior to watching it. But
that's possible. That's definitely possible. I don't know. I remember them talking more about spice in the first one.
Right.
I think the other thing, too, is how much does the second movie rely on you remembering the first movie? And to an extent, I think it's fair for them to expect a person watching the second movie to have seen the first one. But I do think that a writer of a second part or subsequent part in a series needs to remember the real time of passage, like the real passage of time, rather, between parts. Because they should have had a line and they've been like, spice production is low. We need spice to do X, Y, Z. It's very important. Like that, like it could have been easily done.
So in the book and in the early movie, the Dimension Navigators and the Navigator Guild, not mm-hmm. a single word of that mention.
Right. So we don't even know from the movies why spice is so important. Huh.
Yep.
That's a big oversight. Like, your audience is a science fiction audience. We care about that kind of stuff. We want to know, you know? We want to know, like, okay, we're doing spice. Why does it matter? And it's like, it's a really big fucking deal in this universe. This is, like, really important shit. It's not just, like, tasty, yummy spice.
Right, turns your eyes blue. For those of you who don't know, spice is required for spaceflight. So there's a navigator guild that drives all the spaceships around.
Mm-hmm.
And they require spice to do it. So without spice, there is no space travel. So
it's super, super important, which is why Arrakis is important. You're right. That is not mentioned at all. That's silly. They needed to include that. That would need to be included. Well, I mean, overall, I think it's a good movie. Do you think they're going to do a part three?
It felt like that at the end, right? So that they, but I mean, there are so many books, so they could probably continue.
As far as I know, movie-wise, they've never, there's been adaptations of the book Dune, but there haven't been adaptations of the subsequent books in movie form?
No, I don't think so, no.
Okay. Someone was telling me there was an adaptation of the later books in like a short series kind of form, and they said it was on YouTube, but I haven't seen it or looked into it. But in like a big box office kind of way, there hasn't been. And I don't know that I trust them to do it. Because
I don't know, I haven't read any of the other books. So everybody, you know, most people who read Dune just read Dune and never moved on to the following books. And from what I hear, quality kind of drops off.
It also, so I know the plots of the subsequent books. I haven't read them, but I read summaries. And one of my friends is a huge Dune fan. So he's like, oh man, they should make this and this. And then I'm like, okay, calm down. But the stories get really broad. They get really like out in space, you know, kind of space opera kind of stuff. And that's really hard to adapt to screen, especially to a movie format. Again, a television show format is different, but a movie format, it would be kind of like trying to adapt the A Song of Ice and Fire books to a movie. Like there's just too much going on
right,
for you to successfully do that. So I don't know. I mean, I think Timothy Chalamet is very popular who plays Paul. Zendaya is very popular who plays Chani. You know, if they can put them as the leads on a movie, they're going to make money on it. So I could foresee them doing it for that purpose. And I know Chalamet and Zendaya both have given interviews saying they really enjoyed filming Dune. They really liked it. It's a unique little story, so I could see them doing that. There's been several funny memes you and I have seen around the internet about Dune. One of them is that for some reason Timothée Chalamet keeps being cast in roles where he wants to marry one girl, but he has to marry another girl for a political reason. Now, there's two movies, Little Women and this one, where Timothy Chalamet has to marry Florence Pugh when he doesn't want to. And it's just like, the happenstance.
All right.
All right. Well, what do you think? Should people see? I think people should see.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think it's just the visuals are great. One thing that I've been thinking about, which is kind of along Neil deGrasse Tyson's, I'm reading a book called The City of Mars, which is written by a couple of space nerds about what it actually would take, you know, what kind of real problems you would have having tried to live in space and spaceships, or what it would take to get to Mars and live on Mars. So they kind of ask these questions like, you know, where do you get your power from? You know, how do you protect yourself from radiation? So looking at Dune, right? Like, I was thinking, you know, all the Fremen had this cool still suits and all the fabric that they wear. Just, where the hell did they get that from?
Yep.
Even basic stuff like, what do they eat? Like, where's the food being grown, you know? And I think bit of that was covered in part one. Remember the planetologist and the lab?
Yeah.
So I think in the book, there's some underground stuff that they have in this oasis where they can grow stuff and things like that. So a lot of this, you know, how could planet that's completely a desert support life?
Like, and do we have an explanation in the story about how the Fremen got there in the first place?
I don't think so. I think they kind of been always there.
Well, that's a good question, because like if you have a desert planet that has like very little life, how does a human, like a human Homo sapien type thing evolve? You know,
was it you who told me that they there's some backstory that Dune, they wanted to kind of terraform it, turn it into paradise? And then they discovered the spice.
I didn't tell you that, but that would make sense. I don't know that backstory though. I mean, that's part of the thing too, is without spoiling, the worms are required for the spice.
Yeah.
So you can't totally get rid of the worms because you need them because they're magic. But I do also, I love the idea of a story about terraforming a planet. I love so. I love video games like that. Like, there's a lot of video games where you can like terraform area, and I love that kind of stuff. I think it's so interesting. So I would love to watch a story, or you know, watch a movie about that, or read a story about that.
Well, so I have I got the book series for you.
oh no!
I doubt you will read it, but Kim Stanley Robinson has a trilogy of books called Red Mars, Green Mars, and Blue Mars.
Oh yes, you've told me about these books. I should read those.
I only read the first one, but yeah.
I mean, one of the things we were talking about doing next for our podcast is that TV show that you think you won't like. Well, what was it? The For All Mankind, yes.
No, I think that the next TV show we'll be doing is Three Body Problem, which is coming out end of this month.
Ugh, I got to read that book.
You don't have to. We can watch the movie. I've read, you know, there are three books. I've only read two of them, but
As far as I know, let's take it to Google. Science fiction epic. Yep. It's David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, Dad. It's the guys that made Game of Thrones.
All right. So we do that next.
I'm very concerned. I'm very concerned. Yeah. Okay. So we could do that one next. That'll be fine.
I know, for All Mankind, we can also... I can watch it, and then I can be the one who's upset.
Yes. It was recommended to me by a friend of mine who's like really good in terms of media stuff.
No, I think people are saying it's a really good show, but...
Well, but you know so much about like the actual history.
I've been a space nerd since very little, so I know way too much about this.
Yeah. I think that would be good. I'd like to hear your critique.
Okay.
All right, guys. Well, that's Dune Part 2. Go see it, I guess.
Yes.
Not a ringing endorsement, but go see it. So that's pretty much what happens. We summarize what happens in this 3-hour movie in less than 45 minutes. So, yeah, go see it. And next time we probably will be doing Three Body Problem as our next show to cover. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye-bye.